Chapter 12. The experience of almost losing his hand in a shark's mouth took all the starch out of Aldrich for a while, but we tried our best to cheer him up, and so the hours wore away. By morning we were all very hungry again. Remembering the spoiled albatross and tainted fish, we had some misgivings when we hauled out the remainder of our shark meat for breakfast. However, it did not smell too bad, so we tasted a bit. It was better than it had been the day before, fresh from the sea. The sun had almost cooked it, and the meat was somewhat dehydrated by the heat. Also, it had been drenched frequently by salt water and dried by the sun each time, which seemed to remove some of the ammonia-like flavor. We ate all the meat this morning that we could tear from the skin and bones. The lower, or tail, section was so tough that we could wrest little from it to chew, but we had better luck from the middle part and the head. All of this we devoured. What we found inedible in the shark at this meal we used for fish bait. All our attempts to fashion hooks from the shark's bones failed as utterly as had our plans to fashion barbs from parts of the gun. There was anything but a lack of patience in our efforts, but in the end we had to abandon, regretfully, the whole idea of catching our fish in the traditional way, on a line. The shark meat seemed to act as a purgative for Jean and me. In all our time in the raft, 9 days now, none of us had had a bowel movement, although our kidneys functioned normally. Today, as a result of our first good meal of the voyage, Jean and I had normal action. Incidentally, this was the only one. We were not to be allowed another. Tony was not so fortunate. He complained for several days about stomach cramps, but could not achieve a movement. Finally, about a week later, he managed a passage, and after that he felt much better. 9 days of continuous exposure had not yet hardened our skins against the sun's fierce rays. Our beards, long and unkempt by now, protected our faces partially, I suppose, but our lips and tender noses continued to suffer. They burned raw, peeled, and painfully burned again. The round patch on my wrist, where I had worn a watch for many years, felt as if it had been seared by a branding iron. Most of the time this spot was covered by a heavy scab until the scab fell off, and it blistered and scabbed again, and again, and again. We had a lot of trouble with our lips, especially Tony. Stinging saltwater baths, which we could not avoid, continually irritated the cracked and blistered flesh. When seawater splashed in Tony's face, he could not refrain from licking the brine from his lips with his tongue. Then he would bite them in his pain and start them bleeding. My own lips were split and cracked from sun and salt, but I was careful not to bite them or irritate them in any way, and they would heal, later to split again, of course. Tony's never healed once and bled throughout the voyage. The heat gradually increased as we worked southward. February and March are the midsummer months in south latitude and also the rainy season, so we hoped for increasingly frequent showers so we could save some water against a non-rainy day. The wind varied somewhat as we entered the second week. At times, we would have to put out the sea anchor to check adverse drift, but usually this would be for only a few hours at a time. Generally, the wind bore from the north-northwest. During these days, we averaged about 40 miles a day going south and slightly east. The marking of the chart at sundown became, like the prayer meeting, a ceremony that was eagerly awaited in the deadly hot monotony of our days. Any small activity, any new thing to talk about, relieved the growing mental tension. At times, the rubber tub seemed to press in upon us, as the need for space to stretch our aching limbs became a torture. Not even in a chain gang, I think, have three men been confined so close together for so long. There was rarely a time that two of us, at least, were not in actual contact with some part of our bodies. When we were all sitting up at the same time, we could perch away from each other on the inflated sides, but even this was as if the three of us were sitting on the edge of a flower pot with our feet rooted together. Our dispositions were beginning to show the strain. So far, we were maintaining a careful affability in our relations with each other, but polite answers were beginning to come more slowly and with obvious effort. Our inability to sleep or even relax comfortably was having this result. So our minds were greedy for any diversion. The boys watched with great interest as I fiddled with the little celluloid mileage scale, figured mentally, and finally drew my deliberate marking for the day on the jacket chart. Then, with all the dramatic timing I could muster, I added another pencil scratch to the growing calendar on the gunwale. Another day, another 30 or 40 miles. The boys discussed our progress with me and asked a lot of questions. I explained the whole process, and Jean and Tony listened raptly. Neither of them knew a thing about navigation, so at their suggestion I began giving them elementary instruction. They had no idea of direction. Neither one could tell north, east, south, or west from the sun, moon, or stars. I explained that early in the morning, when the sun rose in the east, there was a good chance to get our reckoning, and that when the sun set in the evening, it was going to set fairly nearly due west. At night, I demonstrated that the stars were an excellent source of direction. I used principally Polaris, the Southern Cross, and various prominent constellations as they progressed from east to west. I worked with the boys night after night, and eventually they grasped enough so that I could trust them, when they were on watch, to keep fairly close track of our direction. Then I would lie down and try again to sleep, a nightly battle between me and Morpheus, which I always lost. My efforts did not make navigators of the boys, and I was just as glad, as this left the responsibility for our progress entirely in my hands. Meanwhile, Jean's injured finger was beginning to swell, with dark blood pressing under the nail. It was not infected, however, and was showing all the signs of healing nicely. I attributed this to the action of the salt water. The area around the nail was very painful, though, so I took the pocket knife and drilled a hole in the nail with the point to relieve the pressure. It was obvious that Jean would bear for many weeks the scars of his encounter with the shark. I happened to mention this once. "Well, it's a romantic scar, anyway," Tony laughed. "Imagine being able to say that. Oh, that's where the shark bit me." "Yeah, you'll get a lot of fun out of that, Jean," I said. "If I live," he drawled, grinning.